Thanks for the invitation. It's always exciting to come up here. The drive is not exciting, but I always enjoy coming up. Thank you for that prayer. And I really honestly do appreciate your prayers on behalf of the Bible Institute. It is a work that is one that is just continuing to grow, and its impact worldwide is something where I frequently say, and I mean in all sincerity, I'm just trying to get out of God's way, because he's got great plans, far greater plans than I had ever envisioned with the Bible Institute. We now have, if you can wrap your mind around this idea, this little preacher school in Denver, Colorado has over 40 international preacher training schools, training over 1,000 men full-time. Just like the program in Denver is full-time. And just last year alone, our students, we don't keep track of what our graduates do, but just our students baptized, ready, 3,900 people. They established over 100 churches, and they restored 60 churches, including one church in Liberia that had 280 people. But we studied with their ministers. They had three, converted them to the truth. They allowed us to come back and talk to their congregation. And so we preached the gospel to their congregation and baptized the whole church, changed the sign outside the church building. And it was just an amazing thing that you think, stuff like that never happens, but it does happen. And like I say, I would have never thought that something like that could, but God works in mysterious and wonderful ways, and so we're thankful to be a part of that. And I am thankful for this congregation and for your investment in preacher training. Could we get like another 100 just like you somewhere? Because if we had... our problems as far as student support would vanish right away. But you, your investment in Matthew and Haley is much noted and appreciated, and I thank you for that. I thank you for those that you've supported prior to that. And it's a good work. It's a valuable work. It is a necessary work. Otherwise, the school couldn't exist. And so, appreciate you for that, and thank you for your love for the word, for preachers, for getting the gospel message out. And so it's a wonderful partnership, and I'm very appreciative of that for sure. The last one, huh? Actually, it wasn't supposed to be me. I don't know if you know the story, but I was actually scheduled for the middle of July, and my wife had hip replacement surgery the last week of May, and while she went in for her four-week checkup, the doctor looked at, he did x-rays and looked at the other hip and said, you need to have that one done too. And my wife, Kathy, said, I know, and I'd like to get it done. And so a couple of days later, he goes, how about July 24? Well, July 24 was just a couple of weeks away, and she was still recovering from the first one. And so she called me and said, all right, we scheduled the second hip replacement on July 24. And I said, great. And I looked at my calendar and thought, oh, great. I'm supposed to speak at Windsor that night. And so I talked to Brett, my son, and said, any way that you could switch nights with me? And he said that he could, and I'm thankful that he did. Plus, I don't think he could have made it tonight. He played basketball last night and took an elbow in the jaw and fractured one of his teeth. And he went in this morning to have the doctor look at it and said, yep, you cracked it. It was one of his wisdom teeth. And he said, why don't we just pull all four while we're in there? So he had all four wisdom teeth pulled out. So he can't be a smart aleck anymore. He's lost all of his wisdom teeth. And so anyway, it would have been impossible for him to have made it tonight, I think, having had that. So this is it. This is the last one of the summer series. And I'm excited that it was a good series, and I appreciate the wisdom of the lineup when Gert first sent me the list of the available topics. I thought, that is a good series. I'd like to have been able to hear all of the lessons all summer long. So yeah, as you can see, service is what we're going to talk about. You know, a lot of people have considered service to be the lost art. Some, maybe even many, bemoan the shocking lack of servants, a shocking lack of a servant mentality. We are so accustomed to the me, me, me generation. I was in McDonald's a couple of weeks ago, and a lady in front of me was absolutely having a complete meltdown. And she said, "Where is my food? I've been standing in line waiting for over 2 minutes." And I'm going, did I really just hear that? She's having a fit because she's waited over 2 minutes for her food. And I thought, that's sadly reflective of the way a lot of people are today. It's just like, you know, I want it, and I want it now, and I want it my way, and I'm going to have a little tantrum if I don't get it my way. Well, so the idea of serving, the idea of giving of myself in order to help someone else out is really, truly a lost art. You know, what we want to do is we want to break down our discussion into four categories, and I hope that this will be a good way of approaching this and kind of helping us isolate some very important aspects to service. John 13 is perhaps one of the greatest chapters or greatest examples of service that's found anywhere in any writing, any literature at all. You know the background to John 13. Jesus is in his last discussion with the disciples. And he gets up and he girds himself with a towel, gets a basin of water, and then he kneels down and starts washing the disciples' feet. And the thing that is so amazing about what happens in John 13 is actually something that was said in the last two verses of John chapter 2. And that is that Jesus knows man. And Jesus does not need anyone to bear witness concerning man because Jesus knows man. And the Gospel of John then proceeds from there, telling us, giving us examples of how Jesus knows people before they even reveal anything about themselves. So we go from that statement about Jesus knows man, doesn't need anybody to tell him anything about man, he already knows. Then we go to Nicodemus, we go to the nobleman, we go to the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4. And as we navigate through the Gospel of John, we're just seeing example after example after example of how Jesus knows man without any kind of testimony or witness from anybody else. And then we get to John 13. So, did Jesus need anybody to bear witness concerning the disciples? No. So he girds himself with a towel and he gets down and he starts washing the disciples' feet. And you know that in Jesus' mind, he knows that this disciple is going to flee from me in a few hours. This disciple's going to flee from me. This disciple's going to flee as well. This disciple is going to deny me, not once, but three times, just a few hours. This disciple is going to betray me to the Jews in just a few hours. So he knows. He knows exactly the kind of men, but he kept washing. Ever thought about that? He kept right on washing. Now consider the servant in John 13 is God. He's God. He is the divine, sinless Son of God without flaw. If anybody deserves to be served, it's him. But yet he is the one that is serving. That point alone is certainly worthy of our pausing long enough to just think about the magnitude of that. The most powerful, greatest, supreme God is on his knees washing feet. Did you know that in the Roman structure, they had kind of pecking order for slaves? And you've probably heard this before, that the lowest on the totem pole of slaves was the foot washer. That was the dirtiest, nastiest job, and the lowest slave of all did that job. When the master came home, he had the unenviable task of washing his feet. So that makes sense then when Philippians chapter 2 talks about, although he was equal with God, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking on the form of a bondservant. And being found in the likeness of man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So Jesus didn't say, all right, I'm going to go to earth, but I'm going to be top dog. I'm going to be wealthy. I'm going to live a luxurious life. I'm going to have servants. No, Jesus went from top to literally bottom. And when knowing about the kind of death he was going to die, he didn't say, okay, it needs to be quick and easy, painless, just it's over. No, Philippians 2 says, even death on a cross. The brutality of the cross is something that if you've been in the church for very long at all, certainly you've talked about, you've studied, and I mean, it just makes you cringe to think about a nail going through your hand, let alone a nail going through your feet, let alone being hung on a wooden stake and just being suspended there for hours. So Jesus said, yeah, I'll do that. I'll endure that kind of death. So here is Jesus washing the feet. The one so deserving of service is the one that's rendering service. And then secondly, think about the served. As you read the Gospels, you see a group of weak, flawed men. You know, Jesus frequently said, O ye of little faith. You know he said that to more often than any other group? The disciples. You little faith. O ye of little faith. Why did you doubt? They were not great men of faith. And sometimes it was frustrating to Jesus to see their lack of development. And so he's washing their feet, and in a few hours, he knows what every single one of them is going to do. But he keeps on washing nevertheless. And here is the point that I'm trying to make with this first breakdown of service. Jesus served not because they deserved it, but because that's who he was. Service, if we truly get the idea of service, it has nothing to do with the worthiness of the person being served. It has everything to do with the kind of people we are. Jesus just served. And I think we could probably all agree that there wasn't a single man in that room that deserve to have Jesus serve him, that deserve to have his feet washed by Jesus, but yet Jesus did anyway. And the reason he did is something that is actually expressed in other passages in the Gospel of John, or in the Gospel of Matthew. Like Matthew chapter 20 and verse 28, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom. All right, so that was his purpose. He didn't come to be served, but he did come to serve others. But when we think about the example of Jesus, we also can move on and think about the example of the Apostle Paul. He was one that served at great cost. If you have your New Testaments, turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. In 2 Corinthians, Paul is being slammed by a group of opponents that's questioning his apostleship, questioning his sincerity. They're trying to undermine the credibility of Paul in a number of ways. And so Paul writes 2 Corinthians, and he is really on the defensive. But what he does here, while on the defensive, is give us kind of a synopsis of what his apostolic ministry has been like. Notice what he says. Verse 23, are they, and here's our word, servants? Are they his opponents? Servants of Christ? I speak as insane. And he speaks as insane because the answer is such a resounding no that it's a duh question. To even ask the question, are they servants of Christ, is a ridiculous question. Because there, no stretch of the imagination, are these guys really serving Christ. But I'm more so as a servant of Christ. How can Paul say that? Reading on, 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23. In far more labors, in far more imprisonments, beaten times without number. Can you imagine that you've been beat to a pulp so many times, you kind of lost count after number what? He said, I don't even know anymore. Often in danger of death. I've been in danger of death doing mission work one time. Actually, from men one time. We've escaped some near car wreck several times, but we had these men that came that were dressed in suits to the hotel where I was staying. I was in the country of Nigeria in West Africa. And I was about to go teach my class, and they said, you're not going anywhere. And I said, well, I need to go. I've got class in just a few minutes. And, well, my driver, they were speaking Nigerian and said, what's going on? And I said, ask them who they are. Ask them for identification, because they claimed to be government officials, but they weren't producing any proof of that. And I've grown to be somewhat skeptical through the years in mission trips. And so they did produce identification. They were a little bit peeved that we were asking, but they did. And they were the equivalent of FBI. And they said, if we know he's here, then the bad guys know he's here, talking about me. And so our sources have told us that they planned on kidnapping him today. Me. Kidnapping me today. And So he said he's not safe here. He can't stay here at this hotel. And so they this was a period of time, maybe you read in the news that in Nigeria, a number of missionaries were being kidnapped. And there were two that were killed. And so they were on high alert for anybody that was coming in the country and the possibility of kidnapping them. So anyway, I don't know if you consider that in danger of death, but I kind of do. At least there was that prospect. But anyway, we relocated and I went to, actually stayed within the walls of the school I was teaching that had high walls and glass on the top of the walls and barbed wire and armed gunmen that slept most of the time, but they were they were armed gunmen. So anyhow, Paul said, man, I don't even know, often, he says, in danger of death. Five times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have spent in the deep. I've been on frequent journeys, in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. I have been in labor and hardship, through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. Apart from such external things, there is the daily pressure upon me of concern for all the churches. Who's weak without my being weak? Who's led into sin without my intense concern? If I have to boast, I will boast of what pertains to my weakness. The God and Father of our Lord Jesus, He who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. All right, so Paul has had a life of, would you fill the blank in their service? When you read through all of the things that Paul endured, all the things he went through, I'm not sure that service would be the word that comes to mind. More like a life of persecution, a life of tribulation, a life of suffering. But Paul didn't say it that way, didn't see it that way. He saw his life as a life of service, because all of that could be avoided. He could bring it to a screeching halt the moment that he stopped serving. And then no more troubles. But as long as he was serving, Satan wasn't going to give up on him. So when we think about this whole idea of service, the basis of service, the basis of service is the quality of the servant, not the worthiness of the served. Because I suspect that we might look at some of the people that Paul went through so much for and really question whether that was a good move, whether they were worth all of the hardship and beatings and stonings and all that stuff that he went through for people that were basically ingrates. They did not respond positively to the gospel. He says in a number of places, did I run in vain in working with you? So the basis of service, part number one, is the quality of the servant. Jesus, good example, perfect example, and Paul. But if we move on to part number two, we think about the expectation of service. You cannot read the Gospels without being impressed with the importance of serving. Matthew chapter 20, we have this exchange that begins with James and John. And of course, you got to get mom involved, right? To add a little power to the appeal, to sit on Jesus's right and left in his kingdom. And Jesus says, are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink? And they go, we're able. Because they're thinking cup, that is one that's about around a banquet, that's got all this food. And you think you can handle that? We can handle it, Jesus. Yeah, we could do that. And he says, my cup you shall drink, but it's not mine to give. And then he goes on to explain, the cup of suffering is what you're going to end up drinking. But then he says to the whole group that their whole attitude is skewed, because they were a little bit peeved at James and John, because they kind of got a jump on getting those primary spots in Jesus's kingdom. And maybe they were a little bit regretful that they didn't come to Jesus first with that request. But Jesus says, you're just like the Gentiles. They want to lord it over people. But the greatest is really the one that's the slave. And the first is the one who is the one who is the servant. So the Gospels teach the importance of serving. The epistles show how Paul encouraged service. We've got so many passages, and that admittedly was the hardest part of preparing this lesson, is the number of service passages that we were just simply not going to have time to address. But you've got texts like Galatians 5:13, through love, serve one another. So the question is this an option? Can we sort of say, well, I'm going to opt out of the service requirements that God gives? Well, we don't have a choice to not be a servant. It's not an opt-out clause in our Christian contract. It is an expectation of God that we serve. You look at 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 10, God has given each of you a gift. All right, notice how there's nobody that's been left out. Each of the members of the Church of Christ have been given a gift. From his great variety of spiritual gifts, use them well to serve one another. All right, so all of us have a gift. We have different gifts. Use them to serve one another. So there we go. There is a passage that doesn't give us that escape clause, that does emphasize the importance of making sure that we are serving. And so you can't say, I don't have a gift. The Bible says you do. And so you're either calling the Bible a liar or you're in self-denial. But all of us have a gift. And it could be song leading. It could be preaching. It could be serving the church through beautiful prayers that was like said tonight. There's so many ways that we can serve. And so there is that expectation of service. Part number three, I labeled the face of service. What does service look like? Maybe sometimes we get confused on this idea of service. And unfortunately, there are examples of how we as the church have gotten a little bit confused. And so I put together a list of things that the church has been doing, churches of Christ across the U.S. Have been doing. One particular church was engaging in environmental or in an ecological project. So they had led the charge in cleaning up streams and roadsides, planting trees, protecting endangered species. Another congregation was having a free yard sale for their neighbors, which it's good to get rid of things that you no longer need, and maybe it can find a home with somebody that does need it. But the question is that the work of the church is the question. Read about another church that is providing after-school sports programs for kids. Again, that's a good thing, but is that what the church is supposed to be doing? Providing free legal services, community action programs for minorities and inner-city dwellers. Some churches provide exercise and weight loss programs. There are churches that offer free night at the movies for their neighbors. And we could go on and name a bunch of others. And this attitude is recently exhibited in a published statement from a congregation of the Lord's people. They announced that they wanted to provide a gathering place for the community, quote, no strings attached. Come, gather here, no strings, no preaching, no effort whatsoever to convert anybody. They said, we provide karaoke and other entertainment. Movies was what they were talking about. All right, again, there's nothing wrong with a nice place for young people and neighbors to gather. But as a church, if we're going to serve God, what does that mean exactly? There was an article that was in Time magazine, and this actually was not about a Church of Christ, but about a denomination that had a kind of a soup kitchen, and they were offering free food and soup and drinks. And so the news reporter for the magazine decided that he was going to go to that church, and there were apparently several hundred people there that were there to get food. And so he got his food, and then he asked one of the people, is there any chance I could get a Bible? And you would have thought by the look of on the face of the person that he had asked for $1 million. And they go, a Bible? So hold on, the story goes on where they talked to four different church people and there was not a Bible one to give to the person. And so, you know, and I was reading that article and I was thinking, we can be guilty of that same basic thing. And that is that we do good things, but Christ came to seek and save that which was lost. The church has a primary function, and that is to save souls. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that those that are part of the body of Christ are on the right track, their souls are saved, and then we want to expand beyond the borders of this church building into the community and other places in the world to save souls. That's God's primary focus. That should be ours. And so when we think about the face of service, the face of service has an end goal, and the end goal is the saving of people's souls. That is what we want to do. That's what we want to be all about. But a lot of times that's not at all the case. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 6. As he's wrapping up this epistle, he's got an admonition to the rich. And so that's to us. We're the rich. And he says, instruct those, verse 17, 1 Timothy 6:17, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. Now, I'm reading from the New American Standard. You might be reading from a different translation, but most translations have the word good twice in verse 18. Instruct them to do good and to be rich in good works. But in the Greek language, those are two different words. The first word, when he says instruct them to do good, he uses a word, agathos, which is a word that means morally good works. All right. Number one on this list of four admonitions of what the rich are supposed to do with their money is morally good works. Good works that are going to advance God's agenda, God's plan. Because the work of God requires funding. And so it's his plan that the people fund the works that need to be done. All right, so instruct those who are rich to be involved in good, morally good works. That's our primary focus. And then he says to be rich in good works. He uses a different word for good. Kalos is the word that he uses there. And kalos is a word that means generic good. It's a good thing. It may not have a spiritual attachment to it, but it's just a good thing to do. Now, he's talking to individuals who are rich. He's not talking about the church. The church is to do good unto all men, especially to those of the household of faith, Galatians 6:10. All right, so if you like to be involved in community projects, all right, you're going to clean up the streets, you're going to clean up the rivers. I was involved when I preached in Mississippi. I was a regional director for cystic fibrosis. Well, it's a good thing. But that should be a secondary concern for the greater concern of God's agenda. What is it that God has on his mind? So the face of service basically falls into two various categories. First has to do with physical service. Involves some way of helping others. It might include repairing someone's broken down car or something that is damaged in a home. It might involve painting. It might involve cooking a meal. It might involve taking them to a doctor's appointment. There are a lot of ways that we serve other people that involve something that is physical. In Matthew chapter 6, which is why I've got a giving of alms picture here, Jesus talked about not practicing your righteousness before men to be seen of them. And his first example of six examples is the idea of giving alms. And you got these guys that are blowing trumpets and they're doing all this stuff in order to be seen of men. But giving alms is something, acts of charity is something that we might do. The Bear Valley teens annually go to downtown Denver and they hand out bottled water and a sack food lunch to the homeless that are on the streets of downtown Denver. And I remember several years ago, the first time that we had organized this, that the teens were understandably very nervous about this. They didn't know what they were going to find. They didn't know what kind of reception they were going to run into with the homeless in downtown Denver. And then when we got back to the Bear Valley Church building, you couldn't get them to be quiet. They were so excited about that opportunity to serve. So there are physical ways that we can serve, but there's also spiritual service. Now we're serving others by talking about their souls. By thinking about things we can do, it's going to have an impact on their spiritual relationship with God. This can be the hardest kind of service because sometimes it might be confrontational. Sometimes we have to get outside of our comfort zone to say that which needs to be said. But if we're really serving each other, then that service means I'm going to do whatever dirty job I need to do, if it involves helping you with your spiritual walk. Jesus came to seek and save the lost, and he served by giving himself as a ransom. That passage in Matthew 20:28 said. So with Jesus, he did come to serve. And when we think about he gave his life a ransom, that really emphasizes this last point, the cost. The cost of service. While there are a number of things that we could have put in this category, I just broke it down to three. First of all is time. Maybe this is the biggest cost of service. Sometimes it involves hours, sometimes days, sometimes weeks. Some of the people that we serve might be long-term projects because they have a long way to go. And so we need to invest a lot of our time in this person or that family. How about Bible class teachers? It's time. But you're a servant and you're giving your time in order to teach. What about hospital visitation? It's time. Working on the building? Time. Time, time. Every minute we give to service is a minute that we don't have for ourselves. And maybe what we want to do, but, well, we don't have time because we're busy involved in these service projects. When Jesus talked about the second mile, a lot of times it's called the second mile of service. When he encouraged people in the Sermon on the Mount to go the second mile, and you remember the background to that, and I actually had a kind of a story that I was going to read along those lines, but for sake of time, we're talking about time. We can't do that. But so the Jews had marked 1 mile both ways from their home, and they could be required by law to carry the heavy equipment of a soldier for 1 mile, depending on which way he was going. And then when they got to the exact mile marker, that equipment was going to be dropped into the dirt or mud. And they did it with spite. They hated every step. They hated the Romans. But their packs were typically around 100 pounds. So that's it was a lot of weight to carry. So Jesus is saying that you go the second mile. And if the first is the first mile of compulsion, the second mile is the mile of love. And that's what we're being encouraged to do. We're encouraged to go beyond what would be expected. And then secondly, when we think about the cost, is money. Most, if not all of us, are on limited budgets. We don't have endless resources. As a result, there's only so much we can give, only so much we can give. We have the adage, give until it hurts. And sometimes we don't want it to hurt, so we don't give that much. But we should. To be a servant is a willingness to give liberally. And that's what Paul is saying when you study 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. He's encouraging the church at Corinth to be more like the church at Philippi because they gave so unbelievably liberally. They did give until it hurt. They gave so sacrificially that it was going to set that church back for some time. But they did it because of love. They did it because they believed in the mission of the gospel of Christ. And so sometimes we need to take a look at our own pocketbooks, and are we serving through being good stewards of the money that we have been blessed with and entrusted with? And then third, when we serve people, we hurt with them, we cry with them. Maybe the service is that shoulder to cry on. A true servant is not disconnected from the person that he serves, but or she serves, but is involved, as Paul would say in Romans 12, you weep with those who weep, you laugh with those who laugh. And that's the kind of connection that that we have. If we were able to literally walk with Jesus when he was in the flesh, what would serving him look like? Have you ever thought about that? If you were actually among that group that traveled with Jesus from place to place, what would you be willing to do for him? Now, I suspect that everyone here tonight would answer the same way I would, and that is, whatever he asked, I would do. Some served Jesus by feeding him and the disciples. Some by supporting his ministry financially. Some served him by preaching his message for the kingdom. Are we serving Jesus? That really is the fundamental question tonight as we wrap up. As we look at our lives and how we spend our time and money, can we truthfully say we are serving him? So we'll sing the song, to the work we are, what? Servants of God. Are we? Are we servants of God? Well, hopefully the answer with all of us tonight is, yeah, we are serving. We're doing what we can to further the work of this church, to further the work of God in this community. And we're using our talents and our resources and our time in order to serve one another, but also by serving the church at large. I already mentioned that you're serving us at Bear Valley with your involvement in that work. And so it has a worldwide impact, because the almost 4,000 people that were baptized in the last year in our extension schools, well, it takes money to run those schools. And if it wasn't for people like you that were willing to serve God's plan, that work wouldn't take place. So as we think about ourselves, and maybe a hard look at ourselves and what we're doing with our lives, the call to service should resonate as something that is a powerful call of our God. It's something that he wants. You know, the Bible talks about now's the time to work, then in eternity is the time to rest. Now's the time to be involved. Now's the time to get connected. Now's the time to do what it is that God needs done, because we are his workers. He doesn't have a plan B outside of the people that are part of his church. So serving others, that's who we are. That's the way we need to live our lives. So, Kurt, I'll turn it over to you.
And the church said, amen. Danny, I was